I had a very worthwhile time in Chicago, extremely busy, many meetings, 300 people, most of them rather prominent in Christian work, people from a number of different denominational viewpoints, from many parts of the country. I met some whom I hadn't seen for 20 years and had many interesting contacts. And at the end, they signed a statement which was hammered out. It's a statement about 8 pages long, which was hammered out with many different sessions of different ones discussing, and in one group and another group and all together. And then two or three men worked all night on it, a couple of nights. So I believe it's a very fine statement. And it was a very worthwhile time. Yes?
You say all 300 men signed the statement?
I had to leave to catch my plane before the end. And I don't know just how many signed it yet. But I did sign it before I left. But those I've heard from have said that they think most signed it. But I'm just not sure. I hope most did. In some of the discussions, you wondered if anybody would sign, because people were fussing about little points. But when it came to the end, I think there was a pretty good consensus. And, of course, it was not dealing with anything, really, but inerrancy. But inerrancy is a matter that has to be carefully defined, or you can infer other things that you don't mean. For instance, there's big disagreement about the matter of dictation. There are people who think God dictated the whole Bible. There are other people who think the worst thing you can suggest is such an awful thing is that God dictated it. Well, I dictate to a secretary. There's no reason God couldn't dictate it if he chose. But we don't believe he did, because we see such evidence of personality of the different writers. And yet certainly some of it was dictated, like the Ten Commandments. God spoke these words. And so to make a statement that would avoid misunderstanding and wouldn't err this direction or the other that all could agree on was difficult. But I think a good job was done. It's a long statement, and what they were afraid of was that people would pick out a sentence here or a sentence there that might give a wrong impression. So great care was taken to try to avoid that possibility. But I know that Satan's people are very clever at misrepresenting things. And I just hope that nothing is quoted in a way to give an impression different from what is meant. But I'm sure the whole thing will be. That's very good. It went through several editions, and there was a great deal of discussion. So just about every word of it has been carefully studied. But it is very well written, too. I think that a great part of the credit for that goes to Dr. J.I. Packer, who spent the greater part of 2 nights working on the wording, though there were others who made real contributions, too. Well, I better not take more time on that right now. I maybe better go on to mention a question that was turned in to me that I think is very important. So I want to read it to you. It's called a practical question. Daniel 7:10, the judgment was set or the court sat. What do you suggest we do while preaching this passage? Is it possible to bring out an interpretation such as yours without bewildering and distracting the audience? Do we simply mention the problem and our opinion, or add remarks about the difficulties of translation and so on? It's been my experience that people have been very touchy about any change in what their version says. Here, a difference of meaning seems to be involved. Now, this, I think, is a very important question, because the spokesman for God has two very important duties. One is to be sure what God says, and the second is to say it in a way that will get the truth across. Well, now, a person can be sure that God has said that whosoever believeth in the Lord Jesus Christ can be saved. He can be sure that there is only one God. He can be sure that there are three persons in the Godhead. There are many things of which we can be absolutely sure. And the vital task of the Christian's interpreter is to get these things across, which are absolutely clear in the Scripture. And therefore, God sometimes uses people with practically no education who read a few simple truths and present them. And it's far better to present a few simple truths and have people get them than it is to have, give a great deal of truth in such a way that nobody gets any of it. And so this is a very, very vital part of the work of every one of us. And we do not want to confuse people. And if a person says, well, some say this and some say that. I remember hearing a minister who had one of his congregation brought him a big sack of potatoes. And he said, I surely appreciate it, but why did you bring me these potatoes? Why, she said, I've so often heard you say that the commentators disagree with you. Well, I think that she had no idea what he was talking about. And there is no point in that. We have to have some idea of the people to whom we talk, how much they can understand. At the same time, God gave his word not simply to deal with a few simple truths, or he would have given us 2 or 3 chapters instead of a whole Bible. His word gives us a great deal that is absolutely clear, and a great deal that has tremendous relevance at one time and is difficult to understand in another. There may be parts of the Bible that we have great difficulty in understanding today that have just exactly the truth that God's people will need 10 years from now if the Lord tarries. New problems are rising all the time, and the answer to the problems is in the Bible. And so it is we are training people who we hope will be able to give the great central truths of the Bible in a way that they will get them across. But we here have a greater objective than that. We want to train those who can go to the Word and see exactly what it means and what its truth is that relates to situations as they change. And so there are two duties of the of our graduates and people of the caliber we hope our graduates to be. There are two different duties. One is learning what the Bible means, and the second is getting to people the great truths of the Bible. And I believe we should keep these two sharply separated in our mind. So that I feel that it is vital that where you can't be sure what a passage means, you don't jump to a conclusion, but you see what the possibilities are, and then as you study some other passage or as situations change, you may then see exactly what it did mean and how it fits in with the insight you've gotten from some other passage or with the changing situations in the world. So I believe it is tremendously important that you study it very carefully, that we have a certain number of people who are able to go and say, this verse is absolutely clear. This verse has two possibilities, and we are not at present in a position to decide between them. This verse has two possibilities. One of them I feel almost sure is correct, but I'm not going to build a truth on that except as I find supporting evidence from other passages. Now that is a very important part of your work, is your study for understanding of the Word. And a very important part is getting people the truth you need, they need, without confusing them. Now right there is really a second element in this question. Some people are very touchy about any change in what their version says. As someone said, if the King James Version was good enough for St. Paul, why isn't it good enough for us? Well, we all know that was not the case, that the King James Version came 1,500 years after St. Paul wrote, and yet I got a printed piece of literature the other day from a very active Christian worker who actually said in it, are we to believe that God left us 1,900 years without knowing what the true Bible is? Which certainly implies that the King James Version is the Bible that St. Paul had. We know that the King James Version was a translation made by godly men and excellent scholars, aware of the situations of their day, using a language that nobody can speak today. We can understand it fairly well, but there are many words in the King James Version that very few people today understand, because some of them are not used and some of them have changed their meaning. Most of it, we can figure out fairly well what it means. And there are places where the translators certainly erred in their translation. Though on this ground, I find many cases where I think the King James translators, as far as meaning is concerned, did a better job than any recent interpreters have done. But now that the Bible that is most widely used is in a language that most people, that nobody living can understand every part of it without consulting dictionaries of Elizabethan language and that sort of thing. And most people have a little difficulty. So we Christians are so used to it, it sounds perfectly natural, but we don't talk that way, any of us. And consequently, we can be sure that we don't exactly get it in a great many places. And in that situation, it is absolutely necessary that the people of today have the Bible in their own language that they can understand today. And naturally, as in the days of King James, there were a dozen different versions competing for attention. There will be versions competing for attention today. So I don't believe many intelligent Christians are going to stay long in a situation where one particular English version seems to them to be so exactly right that you cannot differ from it. I think that's a problem that won't stay with us very long. People will recognize that getting an exact translation is impossible. And we have a good approximation in a number of translations. The New International Version has just come out. Is, as far as I could see, the best translation that has yet been made. It ought to be with a tremendous number of hours, thousands of hours that were spent by literally hundreds of translators in working on it. It ought to be the best that has come out yet. But it is a very good verse, just came out this last week. In fact, it's to be presented tomorrow to people in Philadelphia. They're hoping to have two or three pastors there and have a press release, and I've been asked to go and participate in the presentation of it. I think that I wish that the time would come again when we have one English version we would mostly use. I doubt if that will come in a number of years. But ordinarily, I don't think in preaching you want to enter into problems of translation. But I do believe that there will have to be times when, if you give the Word of God sincerely, you'll have to say, this Hebrew word, this Greek word, cannot be translated exactly into English. Here is a good approximation. Here's another attempt at it. You'll have to do that. But in a matter where there's such a difference of meaning as whether this is a judgment scene or whether it is a presentation of God's omnipotent power as he carries out the judgments that he's already made, in a situation like that, I would say that ordinarily it would be wise to take the great truths in the passage that are very vital and of which there is no doubt and stress them and only lightly touch on the possibility of a difference of opinion there. I would think that in the ordinary group, that is the wise thing to do. But there will be, if you have an intelligent audience, there will be times when it is wise to enter into a problem like that and show the reasons on each side and see how it fits with other passages. Now that is so important, I thought it was worth our taking a bit of time on that particular question. Now in our lecture, or in our discussion, we spoke about how in chapter 7, we have the new kingdom was G, as we looked at. We noticed the different factors there. And I believe we had finished our general discussion of what is given about the new kingdom in that chapter. And then we were ready to look at H, conclusion regarding chapters 2 and 7. We have four kingdoms described in both of them. Now, as a matter of methodology, when we had chapter 2, I said, from this chapter, you can't tell whether four kingdoms or five. I think that is vital. We recognize. We do not get from chapter 2 the assurance there are four kingdoms. Chapter 2 has either four sections or five, and you cannot tell which. But when you come to chapter 7, this question is answered. And so, 45 years later, God revealed that there were four animals, not five. But there is a second phase to the fourth animal, which is represented by a fifth part of the statue. So there is a very important part of the teaching of these two chapters. And then the four kingdoms there described can be seen in history. We who believe that Daniel wrote this book in the time of Nebuchadnezzar have no problem in fitting them with history. The Babylonian kingdom, the Persian empire, the Hellenistic empire, and the Roman empire. Those who hold the critical view that it was not written until the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and that it goes up to that period only, they have a history of three kingdoms and predictions of four, and they have to imagine a separate Median kingdom, which did not exist. And so, as far as the history is concerned, those who accept it as a genuine book by Daniel have no problem. Now, as to the relation of the second part of the fourth kingdom to the first, it is quite evident that that second part has not yet occurred. The nearest to it would be 400 to 600 A.D., which would come very near to fitting it, but which has, there's a phrase in there about mingling with the seed of men, which is pretty hard to understand. It's hard to know what it means. Personally, I think that what it means will become clear when that period comes. If you say, well, that fits with the period 400 to 600 A.D., that could fit with almost all history before that. So it's not much of a distinctive feature. More important is that the stone hits the statue on the feet and toes. And at the end of the Roman Empire, there was no establishment of a new kingdom which completely destroyed every vestige of the four kingdoms. That is to say, of the qualities that entered into the human government as shown in those four kingdoms. So it seems to me that this second part must be something that is still future. And there we have two possibilities. One is that there is an unmentioned interval, that you have the first part of it, then you have a long space that is not seen, and then you have the second part. The other possibility is that that you have the four great kingdoms as they would seem looking forward from Daniel's time, the first three being taken over by a succeeding one. The fourth one not being taken over, but having many different changes as they were overrun by new peoples, and gradual changes took place so that as the prophet looked forward, he would see that extending far into the future. And there would be that final stage of it yet to come. Both can be represented by the figure of the mountains. As you see the nearer peaks, which look very large, and then beyond them you see others, and beyond you see others. Then beyond that, there may be a space between, or there may be a long ridge reaching a long way. And there may be a great mountain in the distance, which you can't tell whether it comes right directly behind the first part of the fourth kingdom or whether it is way distant. So in between, whether there's an unmentioned interval or a continuing ridge, we cannot be dogmatic as between the two views at this point. Well then, one thing that was brought out in chapter 7, not brought out at all in chapter 2, is what is today generally spoken of as Antichrist. Now, in a way, that is an unfortunate term. It might be better if we called it the little horn. I don't know. But the Antichrist, John said there are many Antichrists. Antichrist is already here. The Reformers declared that the papacy was the Antichrist. There was much to suggest that in those days. Very much then. Of course, the papacy has gone through all kinds of changes through the years. And at the time when the papacy was so strongly opposing salvation by faith alone in such a strong, definite, and to a large extent effective way, it was easy for the reformers to reach that conclusion. We must say, as John said, there are many antichrists. But there is one who is represented by the little horn. And it is ordained customary today to call that one antichrist. I suppose we might as well stick to the term. But since the term can be applied to others, I wish we had another term to use for it. This one who is called the little horn, who fights against the saints and almost overcomes them, and it is only the supernatural intervention of God that prevents him from overcoming them. This one is mentioned in Isaiah 11, where we read about the coming of the Son of Man, and we read in chapter 11 of Isaiah at the end of verse 4, "With the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked." And this word, "the wicked," does not convey the idea of the original to people today. This is a very good illustration of how our language has changed. When I was in Germany, they would refer to me as the large, because the German word "large" simply means tall. It doesn't refer to your girth at all. And they would refer to me as simply as the large or the tall. Well, now in English, if you say the tall, you mean a lot of tall people. We don't use it for one, an adjective with a "the" today. But in King James' time, they do. They did. They do today in German. They did in Hebrew. They do in Greek. In most languages that I know that have different forms for singular or plural, you can put a "the" before. But this word "wicked" is singular. He will destroy the wicked one with the breath of his mouth. Paralleled in chapter 7, when the Son of Man comes with the clouds of heaven, and as a result, the little horn that fought with the saints is destroyed. Paul referred back to Isaiah very clearly in 2 Thessalonians, in the second chapter, where he said in verse 2 at the end of the end of verse 3, "That man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is God," and referred to him again in verse 8, "Then shall that wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming." This one who Paul predicted, this one whom Isaiah predicted, is certainly the one who is called the little horn in chapter 7. Now, whether we are to call him Antichrist, if we do call him Antichrist, let's just keep in mind that the term is used for others. But here is one special one, whom perhaps we should call Antichrist with a capital A, who, as far as anyone knows, is yet to come. I remember back just at the end of World War I, I read an account by a missionary from the Near East who said he had already seen the Antichrist. He said he was living there, was not yet revealed to the world, but he said, of course, he said, "I've seen him perform simple miracles like simply looking at someone and they drop dead and doing things like that," but he said, of course, he'll do far greater miracles later on. Well, many years have passed since that time, so I think that missionary was wrong as to who he thought was the Antichrist. The Antichrist may be living today, but if so, I doubt if anybody could identify him. He might not come for many years. The Lord said that we do not know when the Lord is coming. We are not to know. And so, for all we can say, it might be another century or more before the Antichrist comes. But it is made clear by Paul, by Isaiah, and by Daniel, that there is to be one who will be a great center of wicked power, who will make war with the saints, and he would win the war if it were not for the intervention by the Son of Man. In chapter 2, we had the account of the stone that hit the statue and completely destroyed it and then grew until it became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Here in chapter 7, we have the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. Then we have the beast destroyed, which includes the little horn, of course, destroyed, and his body given to the fire. Not a vestige of it remains, but he establishes a great new kingdom which cannot be destroyed. And as we notice, that, of course, does not mean that there may not be a change in organization after 1,000 years. God is certainly not going to establish a permanent, fixed condition with no change whatever. There's an old idea of some Greek philosophers who thought that God was one like a great wooden Indian, perhaps, that stands there absolutely immovable, unchangeable. Past, present, and future are all the same to him. That is not a Christian idea. Certainly, the Bible teaches that God feels sorrow, that God feels joy, that God does things. To make God into just some sort of a fixed, immovable thing, he is unchangeable in his qualities, unchangeable in his attributes, unchangeable in his love. But he grieves and he rejoices. He is a spirit, and he has the qualities that our spirits have. And so what will happen beyond 1,000 years after the Lord comes back, we don't know a great deal about. There are people who talk. I told someone once how I wished I could climb a certain mountain. I've climbed many mountains, and there are many others I wish I could climb. But there's just not time enough in life. And I said, I used to feel very sad about not being able to climb all the mountains I'd like, but then I realized during the millennium I'll have time to climb a lot of those. And the man said to me, well, he says, you say the millennium, why not say the eternal state? Well, I don't think there's any such thing in the Bible as an eternal state. What will be beyond the millennium, we just don't know. God may have many interesting surprises for us. But all the sin and wickedness of this life is to be eradicated at the coming of the Son of Man. So now we're ready to take a jump forward, which may seem strange, to jump clear forward from chapter 7 to chapter 11. But the reason I wish to do that is that there are certain things that will come out in chapter 7 which are much easier to discuss in connection with it than with chapter 8. And it will make it much easier for us to deal with chapter 8 if we look at these first. Now, I think it would be a mistake to look at chapter 7 first and then look at chapter 2, because chapter 2 was given and chapter 7 came 45 years later. And so we can use chapter 7 to throw light on chapter 2, but we should start with chapter 2. But here we have chapter 7, which was given in the first year of Belshazzar, and we have chapter 8, which was given in the third year of Belshazzar, and then chapter 9, the first year of Darius, whom Cyrus made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, over that portion of his empire, and then we have chapters 10 to 12, which were in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And so these chapters are given in a very short range of time. And there is no great harm done by our looking at chapter 11 first. Now, chapter 11 is a chapter that not many people get a great deal out of, I fear. The archbishop who put in the chapter division certainly didn't understand it, because, as you know, he put the chapter division 1 verse 2 early. And chapter 10 tells about God sending a messenger to Daniel, and this messenger speaks, and in chapter 11 verse 1 he is telling about his difficulties in previous to his bringing this message to Daniel. But chapter 2 begins the prophecy. Now will I show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet 3 kings of Persia, and the 4th shall be richer than they all. And the critics say, according to the book of Daniel, there were only 4 kings of Persia. There were only these four. The author didn't know about any other. He was just ignorant. I have given you a statement, which I hope you all have with you, which records important facts about the history. And it lists all of the kings of Persia, except one. And that one was a usurper who held the power for a very brief time. And I haven't listed them all. I have listed the ones vital to us and then said six more kings and then named the last one. There were actually 10 kings of Persia in the period of the Persian Empire, between its establishment by Cyrus and its conquest by Alexander. Well, this says there will be 3 kings, and the fourth will be richer than they all. And verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up, who we find out is a king who destroys the Persian Empire. Well, the fact of the matter is, of course, that the chapter here is giving us certain vital points and not telling us of what is in between. And so we have here, in order to pinpoint a particular point, we have mentioned just the first 4 kings. Now, the first of these is Cyrus, and I have the dates 559 there when he became king, 546 when he gained his independence and took over control of the whole Median complex of tribes, 539 when he conquered Babylon, and 529 when he died. Then he was succeeded by his son Cambyses, who reigned from 529 to 522. I did not list there the pseudo-Smerdis, which is the name given to a usurper who held power for just 8 months, but certainly could be ranked as a king of Persia. And these three then, Cyrus and Cambyses and Smerdis, well, Cyrus is the first, and then after Cyrus, Cambyses, Pseudo-Smerdis, and Darius. And then the fourth would be Xerxes. Well, I need to call to your attention a little bit about the history at this point. Cyrus, as you know, began there in Persia with a small domain. He got control of all the realm of the Medes, and then he went westward, and he conquered all of Asia Minor. And you see how large Asia Minor is there on the map? He conquered all of Asia Minor, and then he turned south again and conquered the Babylonian Empire. And then he went east again, and he conquered as far as you can see there on the map, clear into the area of India, and conquered, between him and his son, they conquered all of Afghanistan. He conquered, either he or his son conquered northwest India. And his son Cambyses also came down and conquered all of Egypt. So that was the largest empire the world had ever seen up to that time. But after Cyrus's death and after Cambyses' death, this pseudo-Smerdis reigned for 8 months, and then a cousin of Cambyses, named Darius, got rid of Pseudo-Smerdis and proclaimed himself the legitimate king. And he might be called a second founder of the Persian Empire, because Darius organized the empire. Cyrus was busy conquering, bringing all these regions under him. Darius had rebellions all over the empire. The first few years of his reign were occupied with putting down these rebellions, getting the whole empire under his control. But then he organized it in such a way that it continued in great strength for 200 years and was probably just about as strong at the end of that time as at the beginning. But Alexander the Great was a very great strategist, a great fighter, had a wonderful army, and he conquered it in a comparatively short space of about 12 years. But Darius thus raised the empire to the highest point at which it had yet been. And so it says, the fourth shall be richer than they all. The fourth inherited greater wealth and greater power than either of the previous kings had had accepted be Darius at the very end of his reign. And so it truly says, the fourth will be richer than them all. And then the verse goes on and says, by his strength, through his riches, he will stir up all against the realm of Greece. And any of you who have studied ancient history, it used to be at least, they didn't pay a great deal of attention to the Oriental background. But they paid a very considerable amount of attention to the history of Greece. And anyone who reads much about ancient Greece is familiar with the Persian Wars. The Greeks had settled cities, had built cities and colonies along the shores of Asia Minor. And these were great, prosperous Greek cities. They were all conquered by Cyrus. They were part of the Persian Empire, but they didn't want to be part of the Persian Empire. And they tried to gain their freedom. And Cyrus could hold them in subjection fairly easily with his great army. And Darius could hold them in subjection fairly easily with his great army and his wonderful organization, if it were not for the fact that the cities of Greece were constantly sending help to these cities in Asia Minor and trying to help their fellow Greeks to gain independence in their cities on the coast of Asia Minor. And so Darius said, I will put a stop to this. I will conquer Greece too. And he sent a great army to attack Greece and try to conquer Greece, but partly through bad weather, partly through mistakes in strategy by his generals, he failed. And the Greeks were very proud of having fought back Darius' attempt to conquer them. But Darius said, we must conquer Greece. We can't have them constantly raising rebellions against us in Asia Minor there. And so Darius set to work to gather the greatest army the world had ever seen. And 10 years were devoted to gathering this great army. And preparing tremendous amounts of material. But before it was all ready, Darius died. And so the fourth, who was richer than they all, Xerxes, when this great army was ready, started out to conquer Greece. And they say it took a whole week for the army to walk across the bridges, the bridge that he built across the Hellespont near Constantinople from Asia into Europe. It was a tremendous army and a tremendous navy. And the Greeks facing this would ordinarily have had little hope of defeating it. As it worked out, there were a combination of circumstances and the fact that this army contained people with so many different languages it was difficult for them to communicate and to direct it as they should. Some bad storms injured many of their ships. The Greeks were able to maneuver others into a place where it was, where they were at a great disadvantage. Though we haven't time to go into the details of it, but it was a very remarkable thing in history that the Greeks succeeded in defeating this tremendous attempt to destroy Greece. And the Greeks, after that time, were constantly remembering the great glory of their victory over the Persians. And, looking forward to the time when they would completely end the Persian control of the Greek cities there in Asia Minor. And so this statement, by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece, is a very precise prediction of something that took place a few decades after Daniel wrote, if we believe, as we do, that Daniel wrote. Now, according to the critics, this is somebody looking back and giving a correct statement of history. Yes, sir? Xerxes is the fourth, yes. He's the one who, by his strength, through his riches, stirs up all against the realm of Greece. Then verse 3 says, a mighty king will stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Now that doesn't tell us much about what this man is going to do. It points to his great strength and power. But when you read chapter 4, verse 4, you have very specific details about Alexander the Great. And so there is absolutely no doubt that Alexander the Great is the one referred to in verses 3 and 4. And Alexander the Great fulfilled the great desire of the Greeks to get back at the Persians for the Persian attempt to destroy Greece. But there is an interval of well over a century. Xerxes became king in 486. It was about 480 when his attempt to conquer Greece ended. And it was 336 when Alexander the Great became king. So you have 150 years passed over between verses 2 and verse 3. There is an unmentioned interval of 150 years at this point, as you see. There's no question that verse 2 refers to Xerxes. There's no question that verse 3 refers to Alexander. An unmentioned interval of 150 years. And then you wouldn't know much about Alexander from verse 3. It doesn't tell about his conquering the Persian Empire, but that is perhaps implied. We know that's what happened historically, and that is specifically stated in chapter 8. Then in verse 4, when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. And Alexander the Great, after 12 years of constant fighting, in which he performed the greatest blitzkrieg perhaps the world has ever seen, at least when you think of the relation of the materials he had to materials available this century, in view of that, it certainly was that. He was from Macedonia in north of Greece proper. He got Greece under his control. Then he moved eastward and conquered areas there that had never been subject to his father in Macedon. He crossed into Asia Minor. He met a great Persian army and defeated it. And then he marched down into Syria, and he found that he couldn't go further into the Persian Empire without destroying the Persian navy, because he would not have his line of supplies safe. So he spent a couple of years gaining control of the coastal cities there. He spent 9 months in conquering Tyre. Then he went south into Egypt. Egypt had been conquered by Cyrus, had been subject to the Persians for 100 years, and then had gained its freedom. 90 years later, Egypt revolted against the Persians. It gained its freedom after a century. Then, after it had been free 90 years, after its successful revolt, the Persians again attacked Egypt and reconquered it. And they had held it only 10 years when Alexander came. So when Alexander came, the people welcomed him as further protection against the Persians. And Alexander claimed to be their deliverer from the Persians. And Alexander worshipped the Egyptian gods and declared himself to be a successor of the old Pharaoh. But all this took time. Then he marched inland, met another great Persian army and destroyed it, conquered all of Persia and marched clear east as far as India, and then came back to Babylon and suddenly was taken ill there, and after about 10 days with a bad fever, he died. And here was this young man in his early 30s who had done this tremendous feat who suddenly died. And it says here, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity. When Alexander died, the question was, who shall succeed him? Well, he had an idiot half-brother who everybody knew did not have the ability to reign. But you might say he would have a claim to be the ruler. I think he was older than Alexander. But the only way he could rule would be as a figurehead. And Alexander had married a Persian woman. And they were expecting she would have a child. And that child should be the true successor, many thought. And so there was a division of opinion about it. And in either case, they had to have a regent in the meantime. A regent, as long as the idiot half-brother lived, if he became king, a regent for the boy, if it should be a boy who was born, until he would come to aid. And so they appointed a region, and they divided all the vast empire into 20 parts, and different generals, they agreed to control these 20 parts and to rule them. And so it was divided toward the four winds of heaven. But these generals, soon many of them decided they wanted to be emperor. And so Alexander's child was destroyed. His half-brother was destroyed. His mother was killed. Every relative of his in the course of the next 15 years was killed. So not to his posterity, there was no succeeding ruler who was related to Alexander who ruled for any length of time in actuality. Nor according to his dominion which he ruled, no one of these, though they fought for nearly 40 years trying to get control of the whole empire, no one succeeded. So their dominion was much inferior to that which Alexander had held. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. Now you have that picture of the kingdom which Alexander held. It is divided up. And then with the next verse begins with the words, the king of the south shall be strong. And what would you think would be meant by the king of the south? It would seem quite obvious that Egypt is much further south than any other part of the empire. And one of Alexander's generals, named Ptolemy, was more far-seeing than the rest. He saw that this empire would not be kept together. It would be impossible. And he said, I would like to be governor of Egypt. And they all said, oh, all right, if you want to be governor of Egypt, fine. You take Egypt, not. I'll take this section. They divided up. He figured Egypt could not be attacked except that little, very small area coming in from Asia or from the sea. And if he kept a strong navy, he could continue his kingdom safely regardless of what happened to the rest. And with that as a secure base, he might be able to get all the rest of the empire. So the king of the south shall be strong. It was literally fulfilled in Ptolemy. And then it says, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. As Ptolemy fought with other generals, the man who had been governor of the area of Babylon was driven out from his area and went to Egypt and became one of Ptolemy's leading officers. His name was Seleucus. And Seleucus became one of Ptolemy's leading officers, so he can be properly called one of his princes. But Seleucus, with Ptolemy's help, went back up into Asia and in 312 BC established himself in control of Babylon and eventually got control of the whole empire from there north through Asia Minor, most of Asia Minor, and eastward clear to India. So he had perhaps half the area of Alexander's empire. And so it says he shall be strong above him. He was stronger than Ptolemy. He had been one of his officers and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. So up to this point, if you looked forward, you couldn't have told what would happen. But if you look back at that time, you could easily see how Daniel had been able to predict the course of these important events. It was not given to satisfy curiosity about the future. It was given in order that they would see as it happened that Daniel was a true prophet and it would that his words were dependable and would pinpoint to those matters to which he would give more attention later on.